a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, having recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla. Wife had the same name as Elvis Presley. How do you like that? Recently with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius, who was the emperor of Rome at that time, had commanded all Jews to leave Rome. He came to them, and because he was of the same trade, Paul that is, stayed with them, and they were working, for by trade they were tent makers. And he was reasoning in the synagogue every Sabbath and trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. Let's just stop there for a moment. I think it's interesting that it says that Paul found this couple. Now, some commentators think that maybe there was some pre-arranged things. Somebody said, listen, you're going to go down there, you need to find this couple. They're Jewish believers. They actually have the same trade as you. So in a practical manner, Paul's going to be able to join up with somebody that's in his trade, and that's how he can support himself when he gets there. I mean, when you're going somewhere and there's no church, then you've got to figure out a way, how are you going to fund this thing? And as a matter of fact, there's no churches anywhere. He's starting the whole movement. There wasn't a Federal Express, so his home church back in Antioch could necessarily get him funds that quick if he really needs them. So he's doing his work as a tradesman in tent work. Certainly God's capable, though, too, is certainly like a guy like Paul with the magnitude of faith that he had. Maybe there wasn't any prearrangements, you know? And he just happened to find this couple, you know? How many of you just happened to find, you thought, this church? Or somebody happened to talk to you about the Lord one time? Or I just happened to go on a Jews for Jesus boat ride where there happened to be this awesome woman that I just happened to marry, and I just happened to move from Michigan, just happened to be in Boston, just happened to move to New York, just happened to be in everything. Coincidence is God working anonymously. Nobody's here by accident. And whether it was prearranged or not, it was God's way of providing a place for Paul to live in Corinth and work. But what's interesting is it says this couple was in Corinth because the emperor had just made a law kicking out all the Jews from Rome, Italy. And it's kind of interesting because when you look into this, it's recorded in history that Claudius, the emperor at that time, did make a decree expelling all the Jewish people out of Rome in 52 AD. Now, there's a couple historians that were right around that time, born just about the time that Paul died, and recorded, there were plenty of eyewitnesses still around. It'd be sort of like me. I was born just about the time the Korean War ended. And if I decided to record a history of the Korean War, where there's still plenty of vets and people I could talk to get good, solid documentation of exactly what happened during the Korean War. Well, there was a couple historians that were born just about the time that Paul died, and they went back to document exactly what happened. One guy who did this, his name was Suetonius. Cool name, isn't it? They always had such cool names, you know? Sounds like the movie in The Gladiator. He had other names that went with it. It's like Gaius Suetonius something. You know, they always had a three. But anyway, this guy documented everything. And you know what he documented? He documented that the emperor really did kick all the Jewish people out in 52 AD, which would exactly match very closely to the time we're reading about this right here in Corinth. And not only that, guess why the Jewish people were kicked out? Because they were preaching the teachings of Jesus. How do you like that? The first thing that we have is the Jewish people were evicted from Rome for promoting belief in Jesus. Now, how many times have you heard about that recently? Now, there were other historians. There's another guy that recorded things of events that had happened during that time. And he also recorded this. But he recorded that they were expelled, but he didn't include what Suetonius did. Suetonius included that there was this disruption amongst the Jewish people that was causing disturbance within Rome of the teachings of one Jewish person named Christus, which was the pagan pronunciation for the Greek name for Jesus or Messiah, which is Christus, C-H-R-I-S-T-U-S. And it's interesting because we don't really have a lot of non-Christian sources about Jesus. And this is one of them. So here they are, they're kicked out. And think of the plight of these poor people. I mean, nobody likes you. Nobody really likes Jewish people for whatever reason as it is. Anyway, there's so much anti-Semitism because these people never would assimilate with who they were with. Wherever they were at, they always had their own community because they never joined everybody in worshiping Apollo or whatever it was. They had their own system of ethics, morality, and spirituality, and people used to hate them because they would ostracize themselves and never get with the program like everybody else. So number one, they don't like them because of that. Now they're promoting a whole new concept here along with it, that Jesus is the Messiah. So it's like, well, those of you that are old enough, I remember back in the day, All in the Family with Archie Bunker. And I remember they had an episode with Sammy Davis Jr. And he said he was a two-time loser because he was black and Jewish, you know. And so in a way, maybe that's how it was with, Aquila and Priscilla. They were like two times losers. They're Jewish and they're Christian, you know. Nobody likes them. But I tell you what, think of the magnitude of the conversion that these people had to experience to go through the kind of persecution. They're expelled from anywhere they go. And yet they're hanging tough. They're going with it. You know, I have mentioned before about the depth of conversion when somebody has suffered persecution for their faith is amazing. When I first really began to consider the truths of the gospel beyond just the traditional experience I had as a kid growing up in the Lutheran church, which I'm very thankful for. It gave me my foundations. But you know, there's a time in your life, we all know you're not born a Christian. You're not born to believe radical set of beliefs that somebody rose from the dead, some Jewish rabbi from Nazareth. You're not born to believe that stuff. There's got to become a time in your life when you make a conscious decision, do I really believe this radical stuff? And I went through that, and my roommate happened to be Jewish. I've told you this before. We were in a band together, we were musicians, and I at that time didn't even know how to witness to a Jewish fella. And then I found out about this organization of Jews for Jesus, and they had this old guy at that time. This is back around 1981. This guy was probably already in his late 60s by then. And he had been born in Poland in the earliest part of the 20th century, and in the 1930s, studying the Word of God, he came across certain things that really puzzled him. And he began to talk to other Christians, and he began to see that it was about Jesus, prophecies in Daniel that just couldn't be explained any other way. This man, Rockmill Friedland was his name. He died around 1987 or something like that. But I had the privilege of meeting this guy. Amazing guy. Spoke all these different languages. For me, he was the closest thing to meeting a modern-day contemporary Paul that I've ever come. And this guy became a believer, a Jewish believer in Jesus in 1930 Poland. Nobody liked him. Nobody liked him. Then, September 1st, 1939, the Blitzkrieg comes in, the Nazis start to take over Poland. This guy's got nowhere to go. The Jewish people don't like him because he believes in Jesus. He can't go ask the so-called Christians for help. I mean, a lot of the so-called Christians were rounding up Jews in their churches to load them up in the back of their trucks where the exhaust went in the back to kill them, to take them to their mass grave afterwards. Nobody liked this. It was an amazing story. This guy, I don't know how many camps God delivered him out of, something like four or five. I had lent the book out. I don't have it anymore. I wish I could get a hold of it. I don't even know if it's published anymore. Probably somebody at Jews for Jesus would know about it. But he was an amazing guy. And somehow, I got him to be able to meet with my roommate for lunch.
And when my roommate came back, this 22-year-old kids, we don't know what we're... All we know is, you know, two things in our life were the goals at that time. To sleep and have a good time. But he came back. I said, how'd it go? I could tell something happened. What did he say? Greg, all I can tell you is when the guy just prayed for our lunch, and I don't, they were eating it somewhere like a KFC or something. He said, but the thankfulness and the gratitude that this guy had when he just thanked the Lord for his food, he said, my God, if this is faith in Jesus as Messiah, I've got to have it. There's something so genuine. Think one way I heard it put at a conference a couple weeks ago is humility is the mark of God on your soul. I'll tell you what, when you go, if you ever have a chance to hang out with somebody who has suffered much for their faith in the gospel, do it. It'll change your life. I think that's what made Paul's ministry so powerful. The way he had suffered for it. So let's move on. Verse 5, it says, but when Silas and Timothy came down from Macedonia, his buddies come down to join up with them. At that point, it says, Paul began devoting himself completely to the word, solemnly testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Messiah. But when they resisted and blasphemed, he shook out his garments and said to them, your blood be on your own heads. I am clean. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles. And then he left there and went to the house of a man named Titius Justus, another cool name there, a worshiper of God whose house was next to the synagogue. Crispus, the leader of the synagogue, check this out, believed in the Lord with his whole household. And many of the Corinthians, when they heard, were believing and being baptized. When Silas and Timothy arrived, it says that Paul was able to give himself completely to the ministry. Now, I think part of that is that these guys just came and whatever stuff that Paul used to get busy with having to doing, maybe they were able to alleviate a lot of his little extra work that he had to do. But I think there's a good chance that they may have brought an offering to Paul, and at that point it alleviated him from having to even make tents so he could devote himself, it says, full head on with just preaching the gospel. It says at that point after they came, Paul began devoting himself completely. And the reason I say that is it says that Timothy and Silas came from Macedonia. Macedonia is known as one of the most generous churches of the early first century, just from the writings we have in Paul. Just a few years later, Paul wrote a letter to these Corinthians, right? To these people that lived in this city that he had witnessed to. And he wrote them a letter. And in that letter, he wrote about the example that this Macedonian church had given with their extravagant generosity. 2 Corinthians, chapter 8, verses 1 through 4. Read that for a second. I want you to hear this. And I'm going to read it. Sometimes it's good just to read a little different version so that it's like, oh yeah, I've heard that. You know, and then you kind of tune. Let's listen to how Peterson translates. This is Paul writing to these people that don't believe anything right now that he's about to tell them. A few years later, he writes them back to tell them about this Macedonian church, how generous they are. Now, friends, I want to report the surprising and generous ways in which God is working in the churches in Macedonia province. Fierce troubles came down on the people of those churches, pushing them to the very limit. The trial exposed their true colors. They were incredibly happy, though desperately poor. That doesn't make any sense in our society, does it? Incredibly happy, though they were desperately poor, the pressure triggered something totally unexpected, an outpouring of pure and generous gifts. I was there and saw it for myself, Paul says. They gave offerings of whatever they could, far more than they could afford. Listen to this, pleading for the privilege of helping out for the relief of poor Christians. Now, this was a different offering that they took, but if these guys were coming from Macedonia, and that's the kind of reputation they had, I got a good feeling that when they showed up, they said, hey, Paul, guess what, man? You can go full head on. You don't have to make any tents right now. I mean, these people, they had that ability. It says they gave, even though they were desperately poor, they were able to put personal comfort and finances on the back seat to the needs of other Christians. I mean, that's amazing. I know that I've helped other people. I think we all could say that. I mean, we don't have to completely beat ourselves up. I give and I try to, you know, put in the offering like everybody else. It's kind of a funny thing because, you know, we take the offering, you give me my salary, and then I take a piece of it and put it back in the offering again. You know, and then you come in, you pay me again. I put it back in the offering again. You know, and just, but there's something about the practice of taking something that you don't necessarily have to hang on to and say, God, I'm giving this back because there's other people that are more desperate than me. And these people did it. Unlike me, though, when they did it in a way that it deprived themselves of serious needs. I've never done it where it's really been a sacrifice for me. You know what I mean? Like, I give, but I make sure I got my stuff, you know? Well, I guess we could give that because I'll still be able to eat every day, and I still got my savings account, and I got all this stuff, so it's not really going to be a sacrifice. So, yeah, go ahead, give it. We'll be all right. I mean, these people were like, listen, man, they need help. We need to fast. What do you say we fast this week, and the $300 that we're going to give to Walbaum's goes to the Corinthian church? Whew, man, that's faith. That's Bible Christianity. It's radical stuff, man. I think about, what if the church just got a microcosm of the radicalness that these churches had? I read recently some guy that wrote a book, it's by a guy named Ron Sider, and it's called Just Generosity. You know, not that that's all it is, but like the justice of generosity, just generosity. Yeah, I guess he did some math homework. Now, I don't know how accurate it is, but it is daunting what he came up with. He says this. He argues that if all Christians in North America just tithed, just gave 10%, not that we're under the law, but if we're going to take a random number, why not take the number that they used to use in the Jewish community, where you take 10% of their income, and they gave it so that there could be needs met with other Christians. If North America just took 10%, the Christians of North America tithe, the church could feed, you ready this? All the hungry and fund basic education for all the world's children. Plus have enough to fund the evangelistic ministries of the church. That's a nice theory, right? Let's just stick to worshiping. Here's a buck. Wow. And then we get worried. Well, oh, man, I don't want to do that. You know, I give that. I might won't be able to pay my bills. I might starve to death. You're not going to starve to death. God says he never saw a seed begging bread. But let's just say you did starve to death. Be kind of cool, right? There you are. You're dead. Front of God. What are you doing here? Well, Lord, I was so generous to your people, I starved to death. He's going to be really ticked, isn't he? I mean, come on. What are we doing? What are we doing with our lives? What really matters? Hello? I'm just going to ask at this point that you would pray for me and the elders, because we're developing a budget for 2012 right now. I want the imagination of the Holy Spirit for our budget. You know, it's not just a business thing. I don't want it just to be a business thing. Oh, okay, yeah, there's the budget. Okay, we got salary, little bonus. Okay, let's move on, okay? You know what? When the poor saw the budget of the Macedonian church, they celebrated. I'd love to have a budget that when the poor sees the budget of the Point Lookout Community Church, they're psyched. Wow. That's faith. That's the kind of Christianity. And I'm not saying I'm there, man, but I want it. I want to treasure the kingdom of God so much, like Jesus said, if you really discover it, I'm willing to sell everything I have, grab hold of it. And we might have to all kind of come together for 2012, I tell you, because times aren't so great, and we're starting to see it, you know. And maybe we'll just do little sacrifices, you know, like to start. Just, you know, we got to walk before we can run. We have a the Super Bowl. Well, in the past, we're so blessed. It's like, yeah, order a 6-foot hero and you know, okay, everybody show up. Maybe this year, maybe we'll have to say, you know what, everybody bring a pot. We're not going to just be so quick because, listen, man, if the money's getting lower and it comes between a 6-foot hero for a Super Bowl party or somebody that can't pay the rent, I mean, you know, I want to be able to stand before God and say what we need to be able to say. So just pray for us. And I'm not saying that in a trivial manner. I really mean it. I'd love to have the financial guts of the Macedonian church. I would. But here, it's possible that that's why Paul was even able to devote his full time to preaching. Things changed in Corinth because one church was willing to fund a missionary. And then what happens? He gets to go full bore. First thing it says, he was met with resistance and blasphemy. And blasphemy is translated in some other versions that they became abusive. And it doesn't just mean verbal abuse. I mean, this is a whole different thing, man. My biggest challenge is not to see anybody fall asleep when I preach, let alone being blasphemed or persecuted or abused, you know? And what's interesting here, remember we've mentioned this before, Paul wrote to the Corinthians also that he was actually whipped 5 different times by his own brothers, the Jewish guys. And their law prescribed that it would be 40 lashes and 40 lashes only. So they would always do 40 lashes less one to be careful not to exceed the prescribed 40 lashes. And some historians think it's very possible one of those lashings could have taken place right here. Because he was invited up to speak as a rabbi, and then he starts introducing all of these radical ideas that they didn't agree were in the Torah, and he receives a discipline. And if it happened, man, that puts a whole new slant on when Paul stood up and said, wow, man, you know what? Your blood be upon your own heads, as he takes off his bloodied robe from his torn up back and says, you know, I'm clean. I'm going to go to the Gentiles, which was could sound like an anti-Semitic statement, man, but don't you believe it for a second. You have any question whether Paul was anti-Semitic, you go straight to Romans 9 and find out that this guy was willing to trade in his salvation for my brothers. Man, I'm not doing that one. Woo! In other words, I'd trade in my ticket to heaven if it meant my brothers, the Jewish people, could understand that he's the Messiah. Wow. What a passion he had for them. It was just an action that they would do, referring to the prophet Ezekiel when he would give the people a warning. Listen, man, God told me to tell you this, and if you're not going to listen, then your blood's on your own head, man, because I already told you the deal. And that's what Paul does here. And then he says, I'm going to go speak to the Gentiles. Good luck, buddy. Do you have any idea what that means? I mean, you think it was tough in the synagogue. At least these people have some kind of concept of a monotheistic God with some type of moral and ethical and spiritual understanding to start with. And he says, well, I'm going to go to the Gentiles. The Gentiles in Corinth were probably the most clueless people in the world at that time when it came to morality, ethics, and religion. Let me just read you a few things from John Pollock's book, The Apostle. He says, as Paul would have looked up southward from the marketplace in Corinth, there was a skyline that was dominated by a mountain that was actually a dormant volcano. It went up about 1,900 feet. And right on the top of that was the temple to Aphrodite. That worship at that temple was a cult dedicated to the glorification of sex. They didn't have HBO back then, so they had to use something else. It had 1,000 girls that were kept consecrated to the goddess, and their procession, rituals, and individual solicitude so aroused male devotees and set the tone for the city that the ancient world described habitual fornicators living like Corinthians, or they'd say they've been Corinthianized. I don't know, is that as bad as saying they're like New Yorkers? You know, maybe something like a phrase that was coined actually by Greek comedians. In the city itself, there was another temple that was dedicated to Apollo, which had been restored by the Romans and stood as well there. And it also glorified sex along with, music, song, poetry. Linda, I think you were the one I first heard that from. You know what? Same devil, different hat, man. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Then it was Apollo, music and poetry or whatever it is. And man, he says some stuff here. It's like really gets weird. The temple's inner recesses held nude statues and friezes of Apollo in various poses of virility, which fired his male worshipers to physical displays of devotion with God's beautiful boys. I'm not sure what that means, but I'm not sure I want to know what that means. That's weird, man. And he says the theaters were no better. Actually, the plays at the theaters were probably comparable to XXX adult films performed live. And Paul says, well, never mind with the Jewish people, you just don't seem to listen. I'm going to go preach to these people. Oh, well, Paul, what do you know there? Genius move. How did he do that, man? How do you even know where to start? Give me a 5-year program on that one, man, for church building. Well, what happened? Verse 7 says, then he left the synagogue. He went to the house of a man named Titius Justus. Now, interesting here, Luke points out that he was a worshiper of God whose house was next to the synagogue, okay? So he's not Jewish, but he believes in the God of the Jewish people. He was a worshiper of God as a Gentile. So he's got, Paul's strategic still, but he's being led by the Spirit. So he's got a little bit of a foundation amongst these Gentile peoples by one of their own that has accepted the theology of the Jewish people and their ethics and morality. He teaches from his house, which happens to be right next to the synagogue. And then right after that, we find out in verse 8 that Crispus, who was the leader of the synagogue, ends up believing. So God isn't done with the Jewish people. Right here, we see right on the heels of saying, you know what, I'm going to the Gentiles. We see a Jewish person embracing faith in Jesus. Not only him, but he's the head of the synagogue, man. And it goes on to say his whole household believed. That's cool. How many want to be able to write that one down about your household? Whole household was saved. But then it goes on to say, right on the heels of that, and many of the Corinthians, when they heard, were believing and being baptized. How does he do that? I mean, we've said that before. He's got no church, no choir, no leverage at the White House or the Capitol. There's no prayer in the schools. He couldn't exegete the Gospels or the book of Hebrews. Hadn't been written yet. How did this happen? Well, he talks about that when he wrote them a letter. The letters are pretty cool if you want to get a deeper look into these little missionary trips, because about 3 or 4 years later, Paul wrote a letter again back to the Corinthians, and he looked back at that time when he went to go preach to them. And he said this, chapter 2, 1 Corinthians. He says, "And when I came to you, brethren, I did not come with superiority of speech or wisdom." Peterson translates it this way. "You'll remember, friends, that when I first came to you to let you in on God's masterstroke, I didn't try to impress you with polished speeches and the latest philosophy, proclaiming to you the testimony of God. For I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling, and my message and my preaching were not in persuasive words of wisdom, but in the demonstration of the Spirit and of power, so that your faith would not rest in the wisdom of men, but on the power of God." The message puts it, I was unsure of how to go about this and felt totally inadequate, and I was scared to death if you really want to know the truth of it. But then I preached that way with the power and demonstration, and your life of faith is a response to God's power now and not to some fancy mental or emotional footwork by me or anyone else. I'll tell you, one of the most convicting verses I've ever read since I first went into ministry is the chapter just before this. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 17, Paul wrote this. He says that he wants to preach the gospel not in cleverness of speech. Man, if anybody could dazzle you with cleverness of speech, it would be a guy that knows the Old Covenant backwards, forwards, and sideways, studied at the feet of Gamaliel, but he says, I don't want to do that. Why? Man, Paul, come on. You've got the apologetical power, man. Go for it. He says, no. Why? He goes on to explain. He says, lest the cross of Christ be emptied of its power. Whoa. In other words, we could craft a sermon, man. You know, I could work on it. I can get something together, you know, and maybe start off with a funny story and get you to laugh a little bit, and then give you some interesting facts, and then end it with a really nice story, maybe get a few of you to cry a little bit, you know. And Paul says, listen, man, what can happen is people will be stimulated intellectually and emotionally, but there's no shift, there's no transformation in the spirit of their soul. We have to be careful that we're not just getting people to make an intellectual commitment to a concept and a theory as opposed to a real encounter with the living God of the universe. And that's not something we're ever going to be able to do on our own accord. It's going to have to be an intervention of God Himself that comes in and gives us that ability to see things from His way. And you know what? Jesus said, be careful, man, because there's going to be people, like Paul said, that can use wise and persuasive words, and they're going to look like they're Christians. Looks like a Christian, walks like a Christian, smells like a Christian. But when persecution comes, guess what, man? You're going to find out the seed had no root. It was just an intellectual stimulation or emotional moment, but there's no real spiritual root or transformation that had taken place within them. I mean, I got blown away. This conference was fantastic. We went to a couple weeks ago at Jim Cymbala's church, Brooklyn Tabernacle. I mean, Brooklyn Tabernacle. It's not exactly the Bible Belt, if you know what I mean. And he's talking about, listen, man, when we started out there, you got guys on strung out on crack and cocaine. You're not going to be able to go over there and give them a nice dissertation on the four spiritual laws. I mean, you know, the wise and persuasive words are not going to cut it. Either God shows up or nothing happens. And something happened. I mean, you got to see this place. It's tremendous. They got this new theater about 10 years ago. It's pretty cool. It was an old vaudeville theater. The Three Stooges performed there, he said at one point. Now they got Pastor Greg. Yeah. But, I mean, this place is jammed in the middle of Brooklyn. And even Cymbala said, listen, man, I read these words. He goes, I contend to you that we may have never heard yet preaching as it took place in the book of Acts or in the Bible. This is a guy that if anybody's come close to that man, it's got to have been him. He says, I contend to you that we may not have even heard it yet. We've got this thing, the cult of the speaker. Oh, Josh McDowell, man, let me go over there. Oh, Francis Chan, let me go over there. Oh, I mean, Billy Graham, let's go over there. Franklin Graham, Jim Cymbala, whoever. When Jesus preached, he said, what happened? He met them on the road to Emmaus, and afterwards they weren't like, man, that Jesus, boy, he knows how to do it. He matched up this scripture and the other one, and the way he preached, the way he taught. No, what they said is, when he was with us, didn't our hearts burn within us? There was something supernatural that was transpiring within that went beyond, you know, and it's kind of scary because we're so good at wise and persuasive words that I get worried, Lord. Are we filling churches with wise and persuasive words? Because I don't see a lot of power and demonstration going on. To have divine unction. And you know what, man? It's no picnic. It's really a vacuum, a human vacuum of morality and ethics and spirituality in Corinth. And Paul, you know, it seems like if you study Paul, it does seem like he had a little strand that he was somewhat vulnerable to depression. So don't beat yourself up, man, if you wrestle with that stuff. But man, when you're plugged in, God knows when to minister to you and exactly what to say at the right time. Because right in the middle of this, in verse 9, it says this, and the Lord said to Paul in the night in a vision. That's pretty cool. How many would you like to be able to write that in your journal? And the Lord said at night to me in a vision, don't be afraid any longer, but go on speaking and don't be silent, for I'm with you and no man's going to attack you in order to harm you, for I have many people in this city. And he sailed there for a year and 6 months, teaching the word of God among them. And I'm just going to close with this as we go to communion. I remember reading that at least 10, 12 years ago. And maybe you think the church is sparse now. Should have seen it then, man. I think we had 10 on the first Sunday because my parents were visiting. All the way up from the original 4 that we usually had show up. Whatever. And I'm not getting persecuted. I'm not getting slammed or abused. But, man, you know, it's like, did I make a mistake, God? And I read that. things started shifting. And I'm just going to say this, man. I'm going to put myself out on the line a little bit. I talked to Kevin and Joel. I said, just pray for me, because I want to lay this out here. Is that, I don't know how many of you were here, but it's going to be 5 years ago in January that I cast a vision for this community. And I said, you know what? I want to see in the next 5 years something transpire in this community of spiritual significance, you know? And I even put a number on. I says, how about 100 people from the community that start attending our church? And we got 3, and one of them moved away. And it's like, I don't know, I'm not going to mention that vision, you know? I'm just going to, you know? And actually, man, I'll tell you, it was 2 weeks ago. I got on my knees and I said, God, if I made a mistake, I want to confess to my congregation. I'm very careful. I don't want to say things that God didn't say to me, man, because you know what? If I was in the Old Testament, you get stoned for that. And I'm not talking about partying and having a good time, you know? I mean, it's pretty serious. I said, God, did I make a mistake? Was I not supposed to say that? What are you saying? And I always am careful not to say I believe in Bible roulette, but I'm starting to get converted, man. I mean, this is God's word. And sometimes you're just desperate. You're like, God, man, I'm sorry, I got to hear from you. You know, I've got to have you speak to me, God, please. And I just open it up, and it just randomly fell open. And I started reading right at the bottom of the page, Habakkuk 2, verse 2. And it read, then the Lord answered me and said, that's pretty cool. Maybe God's going to say something to us. But sometimes you do that, right? And then it talks about all this bloody judgment and everything. Oh, that can't be God, right? But I read it, and the Lord answered me and said, record the vision and inscribe it on tablets that the one who reads it may run. For the vision is yet for the appointed time. It hastens toward the goal, and it will not fail. Though it tarries, wait for it, for it will certainly come. It will not delay. So there it is. Maybe I made a mistake on the timing, but I still believe God's got something significant He wants to do through us here. And you know what? If I have to spend my whole life without seeing the promise fulfilled like other saints did in Hebrews 11, that's okay, man. Maybe Brandon, maybe you'll get to see it explode, man. Or maybe Alyssa will, you know? Or maybe, you know, some of our new members, you know, Noah, or one of the, you know, who knows? You know, Aspen's going to see this place ignite with the power of God, you know? But we're here, and we're going to be faithful. And I was like, okay, well, do I need to write it down? It says, you know, scribe it down or write it. And I'm going to, January 1st lands on a Sunday. I'm going to recast it and just pray about how to just recast it to everybody. But I felt like God told me, again, I have these, you know, I'm still haven't gotten to the, you know, technology where, that's cool. Let me, you know, I still get out the pen and I'm like, oh, that's pretty cool. Let me write that down. So I have a rubber band stack of index cards. When I really read something that I feel like, man, that's God. I need to have that to look at once in a while. And I saw this, and I said, this is it, man. This is what we need to have inscribed and concentrate on before we go forward. And I don't know where I got it. It sounds too good to be me, so I don't think it was me. If anybody else here knows, let me know. I'd like to know. But I wrote it down. It says, being productive and getting things done are high priorities in our Western culture. Praying and enjoying God's presence for no other reason than to delight in Him is a luxury we can take pleasure in that once we get to heaven. For now, there's too much to be done. People are lost. People are lost, and we're entrusted with the gospel. I used to question whether monks were truly Christian. It almost seemed like kind of escapists. They go into isolation and pray all the time. Don't they know that the laborers are few, according to Jesus, Matthew 9:37? Life of work for God, not nourished by an interior life with God, will eventually be contaminated by other things like ego, power, needing approval, wrong ideas of success. Our sense of worth can shift from unconditional love from Christ to works and performance. Our activity for God can only properly flow from a life with God. We cannot give what we do not possess. Self-care, spending time with God alone, is never a selfish act. It is simply good stewardship of the only gift I have, the gift I was put on earth to offer others. Here's what I wanted to do with communion this morning. I'm going to ask that everybody, some of you might have grown up in like the Lutheran church or the Catholic church like me, and you remember when communion used to be a little more formal, and you come up and receive. Well, I'm going to ask if we could have two ushers on this side, one holding the bread, one holding the juice, and I'm going to ask if someone on this two side would do the same thing, bread and juice. And we're going to do one pew at a time. We'll start with Maureen and Roz, and you come up and you file. And as soon as the pew is done in front of you, then you come up and file. And I inscribed it, what I just read to you. After you take your communion, I want you to take this home. And I want you to read it.